Now, stay tuned for Mrs. Green Goes Mainstream, a fun and informative green talk radio show that features guests from all over the country who talk about how living green can improve your lifestyle and be fun. Visit Mrs. Green's website, www.mrsgreensworld.com, for more information about her guests.
Hello, Tucson. Hello, world. Happy Saturday. Happy not-so-hot Saturday. We're getting a little bit of break for those of you that are listening who are not in Tucson. Some cloud cover from that wonderful sun that we love so much that solar powers this region. Someday, this is Mrs. Green Goes Mainstream News Talk 790 KNST. Thank you so much for tuning in. And we are so very fortunate today to have in studio Robert Glennon, who is a noted author, writer, and the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. Good afternoon, Robert. And I won't be saying that whole long title every time because it's really, that'll take up half the show. But I want people to know that there is a lot there. So I just said, okay, I'll say it once really well and slowly. And today we'll be talking about his book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. And I do want to talk to you that are listening, just say that if you go on and Google Robert Glennon, you can find excerpts from the book that are excellent. I have the book. I have marked up dog-eared copies of the book. And so I know what I have so many questions. It's not even funny. But anyway, you would be able to call in and ask questions today, 520-880-5678. And I cannot imagine that you will not want to hear everything that Robert has to say living here in the Southwest. And we welcome you so much, and thanks for coming. So I have a very few quick announcements. As always, this show is sponsored by Chapman Tucson. Thank you so very much for your support of Mrs. Green. And I do want to talk for a second about America's Greenest Workplace Challenge, which is on the Mrs. Green's World website. And please check it out for details. And the purpose of this is truly to celebrate employers and companies who are walking the walk and making a difference by being green from the inside out. The responses have been great so far. The contest was announced, and within a day and a half, we had seven entries from the little, teeniest, tiniest, most wonderful company to big ones that I don't want to steal the thunder, but there's a lot of interest. And the thing that I love about this is we celebrate green practices, and don't think your company is too small or not making a difference, because every little bit you do matters. And everybody that's visiting the Mrs. Green's World website will have an opportunity to read about your company and see what you have written that is about sustainability. I also want to start doing a little shout out about there's a free event coming up on Labor Day at the Children's Museum, which is one of my favorite places, one of my favorite live remotes. We're not doing a remote because it's a Monday, it's Labor Day, and it's called Sun Power. It's free, which I love, and there will be lots of fun activities for the little kids and the big kids like me. It is sponsored by TEP Bright Solutions, and be sure to come and find Mrs. Green's table and say hi. Again, details are on my website, and you can post your event on the Mrs. Green's World website for free, and people do check it, and they do show up. So if you're having an event, please feel free to use that service. And then if you don't do anything else today, I'm like, I should be a little, I'm like a walking billboard for the Wall Street Journal. And I'm serious. There's an article in there by Scott Adams, who writes the cartoon Dilbert, which I find absolutely amusing every time I read it. And it's called How I Almost Saved the Earth. It's about building the greenest house on the block and what a challenge it is. And it's so, so, so on point and hysterical. So it did make me laugh out loud. If you don't laugh out loud, you can send me an email or a text. But he's so funny. So much of what he says is true. And it was funny to me to read the article. And yesterday, Robin Wilson, who was our guest last week, who wrote The Kennedy Greenhouse, which is all about eco-friendly home from the foundation to the furniture and the ground up, arrived yesterday. So it's great. So let's go on with the show to another well-respected author, well-respected expert nationally on water, internationally on water. There's no hyperbole for this. So let's start with the question that there's a lot of things that I don't know about your journey, but I've heard you speak, I've read your book, and I want to know why water, of all the things that you could have picked, this is your specialty. You know more about it than most people will ever even want to know, I think. So how did you decide, or what was the journey to having your specialty be water?
Good to be with you, Gina. It's a great question. I grew up in the East around water in New England and lived in the Midwest around the Great Lakes. I do a lot of things outdoors, recreational things. But I really found water as an academic field when I came to Arizona in the mid-80s. And toward the end of the 80s, there was the woman who was teaching water law at the U of A Law School left, and I picked up the class, and I have never looked back. It's been just so much fun. I'm tickled to be able to go to work every day. I have wonderful students. I'm privileged to work on whatever topic I think is of interest. It's a real luxury.
And my real question was, my first question that popped in my head was, do you sleep? Because he's a professor of law. He writes books. And writing a book is no small feat. Then you have to go promote the book. And you are on other stations around the country. I know that, I think you've been on NPR in Chicago. I mean, there's a long list. But
quite a few, a number of NPR stations. I was on the Jon Stewart show, The Daily Show. That was an amazing experience.
I wish I had seen that.
You can still get it if you go to either my website, which is rglennon.com, or to the Daily Show website. You can pick up that clip. That was quite remarkable.
I will pick up that clip.
Quite remarkable. And I've, since the book came out about a year ago, I've been on really virtually a nonstop speaking tour.
You're in demand.
The phone has been ringing off the hook. And unfortunately, I just can't say yes as much as I would like to. So
because you do have to sleep. It's a human requirement. I know. You are in demand, and I know your schedule is rigorous. So I feel really blessed that you took the time to come out here on Saturday and be on my show.
Wouldn't have missed it for anything.
Well, I'm glad. Okay, so we have – let's start in little segments because there's – you know, the three-hour show would maybe inadequately cover it. This will be a real push. In one of the parts of your book, you talk about the crisis. I think that's where we start.
Yeah.
Talk about the crisis.
Well, it's surprising because I think most of us in the United States don't think there is a crisis. And the reason for that is that we're spoiled. We wake up in the morning, we turn on the tap, and out comes as much water as we want for less than we pay for cell phone service or for cable television. But the reality is that there is a crisis, and it's not just confined to the arid Southwest. For example, in South Carolina, a paper company, Bow Water, had to close its doors a year and a half ago because the low flows in the river prevented the company from discharging its waste flows, and that cost 300 or 400 people jobs. Nearby in Atlanta, the city came within 90 days of having the principal water supply, Lake Lanier, literally dry up.
I remember that.
The state of Georgia denied a permit for two new power plants. In the Midwest, the largest of the Great Lakes, Lake Superior, is too low to float fully loaded cargo ships, requiring the offloading of hundreds of tons of freight and dramatically increasing the price of shipping. And then, of course, we can turn to the West, and there are just a legion of examples of where there are problems with the lack of water.
The story goes on. So we are really going to, I mean, time will fly because we are having fun. We've got great content. So we're going to go to a very quick break. For those of you that are listening, do not touch that dial. You can call in 520-880-5678. Robert Glennon, Unquenchable, News Talk 790 KNST. You're listening to Mrs. Green. Welcome back, everybody. This is Mrs. Green Goes Mainstream, News Talk 790 KNST. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We have a really wonderful in-studio guest today. His name is Robert Glennon. He is a professor at the University of Arizona in the School of Law, and he is author of another book. This is his latest book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. And before the break, we were talking about the crisis, and I think that it's you can articulate some more examples of that. But then to me, what I always go to as a business model, it severely impacts the economy. And as far as I can tell from my research, it will continue to do that. It will have negative effects if people don't wake up and realize, folks, this is not going to be business as usual.
Absolutely, Gina. I think that's one of the themes in the book. I mentioned the factory before the break. The commercial fishing season off the coast of California and Oregon has been canceled for 3 years running, idling hundreds of fishing boats and decimating communities up and down the coast. In Southern California, scores of residential and commercial projects have been canceled. So we think of water as though it were simply an amenity or an environmental issue, but it's really an economic issue. And We may fret in the United States about running out of oil, but water lubricates the American economy just as oil does. And it's not just companies like Coca-Cola or, say, Kellogg's for growing grains that need water. Virtually every company has water as an input, including some surprising ones. In Unquenchable, I have one chapter about Intel. I have another chapter about Google. Well, who would think that Google needs a lot of water?
Massive,
but they do.
Massive amounts of water. I love that part in your book.
Very surprising. So it's a crisis that's economic in nature, not just environmental.
And I heard, I don't really like to put this out, but I heard a speaker maybe 2.5 years ago, and they said the wars of the future, which I don't even like to think about wars of the future, will be about water, not about oil. And you, when you see who's buying up water rights, they're stockpiling. Anything that's left, big money, is buying water.
Well, if you look in, particularly in Asia, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that with the impact of global warming on the glaciers there, the fight among the countries of China, India, Pakistan over international rivers is coming. There's no question about it. It's
and I think
it's
getting to
that,
I really would love you to go through the whole cycle in your book of the hydrological cycle, because that really leads itself into a lot of other discussion about why, as Americans, we are so complacent about it, and there is nothing wrong with running the water and going away and coming back and leaving it on while you're brushing your teeth and watching TV. It's really awful. Not in my house anymore, I can tell you that right now. We're like frugal about water. So
that cartoon of the hydro illogical cycle, I first saw it from a hydrologist at the University of Arizona, Martha Whitaker, who gave it to me. I don't know whether she created it or whether she got it from someone else, but it shows the shortage of water causing concern, and the longer there's a shortage, we become panicked and then truly alarmed. But then it rains, and then we're back to business as usual. We're apathetic again. And that really is, unfortunately, a function of human nature. We all are leading busy lives. We have jobs and families and things that we need to do. So we have not paid nearly enough attention to the issues of water.
And it goes into the crisis, the complacency. I'm old enough to remember the gas crisis when we had to stand on lines and get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to put your, you know, get your car so that you could get gas for the car. And it was really frightening. It was the first time in my lifetime that I had really experienced the possibility of lack in the United States.
Well, there are some places in the United States that need to truck in water, including right here in Arizona, up in some of the Navajo Nation. Some Hopi folks need to truck in water. But also non-Native Americans, west of Flagstaff, the same thing's going on. Even in the humid southeast, a little hamlet of Orme, Tennessee, a couple of years ago, literally ran out of water and had to truck it in.
So what about people who say, and I've had people say this to me, I could not make this up, well, I mean, have you been to Alaska lately? There's plenty of rain up there. Look at all the ice, blah, 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 blah. Can't we get some water from Canada? I've had all those things when I'm talking about turn off the water, don't flush the toilet, don't take 20-minute showers.
Right.
What's your response to that based on fact and research?
Well, there have been some long-distance transfers of water. Right here in Tucson, we have the Central Arizona Project.
Yeah.
That's 330 miles long, that canal. It takes Colorado River water. Periodically, there are some wild-eyed ideas about moving water over mountains, under tunnels, and the like. Right now, there's one going on in Colorado. A fellow by the name of Aaron Millian would like to tap into Flaming Gorge Reservoir, which is between borders the states of Utah and Wyoming, and build a pipeline that would parallel the I-80 corridor, bring the water over to Denver and all the way down to Colorado Springs. Now, you can just imagine the environmental permitting nightmare that is in front of him.
And the cost?
But the cost, billions of dollars. Plus, he has to pump the water over the Rocky Mountains.
There are simpler solutions
than thinking that we can tap into an iceberg in the Arctic or a river in British Columbia. We can look closer to home. We need to get our own houses in order.
And there's a huge difference to me between conservation and deprivation. And nothing in your book suggests that we have to deprive ourselves. Being conscious of our water use as a citizen, as a consumer, is a huge step to be able to take that. And I just...
Then there's some simple steps. There's the one, there's some that are pretty widely known. You mentioned turning off the water while brushing your teeth. But one that I include in the book that surprised me was the kitchen food disposal. And Val Little, who has a conservation program here in Tucson, did a study of water use by dishwashers. And even if you have an aerator on your kitchen faucet, if you run your food disposal 2 minutes per day, by the end of the month, you will have used 150 gallons of water to get rid of food scraps, which could easily be put in the trash or put in your compost pile. So that's something very concrete, very specific, that we can do to save water.
And
there's another example, which I think your listeners will find even more surprising. It's not widely understood, but there's an incredible connection between water and energy. It takes a lot of water to produce energy, and conversely, it takes a lot of energy to pump, move, treat, cleanse, and deliver water. So much so that some researchers at Virginia Tech University did a study on how much water it took with various kinds of technologies to run a light bulb. And the stunning figure is that a single 60-watt incandescent bulb that burns 12 hours a day will, by the end of the year, consume as much as 6,300 gallons of water.
I'm not kidding.
So if you want to save water, turn off the lights.
I thought you were going to say 63 gallons.
6,300 gallons
for one light bulb.
One 60-watt light bulb.
Ouch.
Right.
So then it does also, we changed out almost every light bulb in our house to CFL.
Right.
And can't wait for the LED ones to be able to go to an affordable rate for the whole house. But that is one step also that
you
can take.
Yes, it is.
6,300 is blowing my mind.
Yep.
Okay, you have another example till I catch my breath? It's like, holy smokes, that is really big.
Well, let's see. We waste some water in some pretty funny ways. One of my favorites was during the drought a couple of years ago in Atlanta when, as I mentioned, they were looking over the abyss at Lake Lanier that was almost dry. There's a theme park in outside Atlanta called Stone Mountain. And Stone Mountain partnered with Coca-Cola to bring online a new feature, a new exhibit. And they called it Coca-Cola Snow Mountain.
In Atlanta.
Okay,
really,
and
one of those cold climates.
they brought this thing on online on September 27th in the middle of the drought on a day when the temperature hit 81 degrees Fahrenheit, and they were making snow outdoors. It's just stunning. We humans have an infinite capacity to deny reality.
And let's talk a little bit. I'm obsessed with the water that flushing the toilet wastes. It blows me away because I say, and I've said this to my grandchildren, anybody that'll listen, that's water that's in my toilet that I flush down, I could drink.
That's right. I take dead aim at the American toilet, and I have a whole chapter on that.
It really
makes me laugh. Historically, the toilet, of course, was a benefit to public health because before you had that sort of plumbing system, you had cesspools and privy vaults, and there was a real public health problem from waterborne illnesses, typhoid, cholera, really the kind of stuff you're seeing in Pakistan right now going on in the midst of this flooding. Well, that was happening in American cities. So way back when, the indoor plumbing was a benefit, but it's long gone past that. And if you think about it, it's truly bizarre because we take water that is, in fact, drinking quality water that's sent to our homes, but we only use 10% of it for cooking or drinking. Fully a third of it we use outdoors for watering our landscapes or our lawns. And of the indoor use, fully a third of that we flush away. Well, that's a lot of water.
Does everybody hear that? Can we, press pause here? A third of the water we flush down the toilet. When I first heard you speak, I sat there and say, are you kidding me right now? I've never felt the same about a toilet again, which is why John Smith, the Arizona Green Plumber, put one in, and I'm getting both of them traded out in another week. It makes me feel guilty, and there's nothing I can do about using it. So it's like, okay, let's change it out to a high-efficiency toilet. We use 2/3 less.
Yes. They're much, much more efficient. Well, I even go further. What I think we need is we need a national commission. Congress needs to set up a commission to explore waterless ways to deal with human waste, because the toilet wastes water, wastes money, wastes energy, and it compromises human health, because with the wonders of modern medicine and with the development of all of these high sophisticated drugs, we end up with pharmaceuticals in our water supply. So whether you're taking birth control pills or antibiotics or whatever else you're taking that you've gotten from a pharmacist.
Xanax, Ambien, I mean, there's all a list. The list
all
goes on. Right.
And our bodies absorb some of that, but then we excrete the rest, we flush it away, and traditional wastewater treatment plants do not remove those chemicals. And some of them are very strong, powerful chemicals that have endocrine disrupting aspects to them.
And that's showing up everywhere in
yes,
research.
It is.
This is not a like far out, you know, wacko idea. They're showing it so much, especially in the development of children.
So,
I mean, it's so accelerated.
So let's not rebuild this bizarre system. Let's figure out a new way to deal with human waste.
Okay, we've got to go to a quick break. News Talk 790 KNS team, Mrs. Green, our in-studio guest, Robert Glennon, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. We'll be right back.
790KNST.com.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Mrs. Green from Mrs. Green Goes Mainstream, News Talk 790 KNST. Our buddy, Scott, from Legendary World is back, and I am thrilled. And my question for you is, not to put you on the spot, but let's talk about this a little bit. There is so much going on in what I call the social media arena. People, I subscribe to blogs that are all about everything you can think of, energy and travel and eco-consciousness and whatever. Good bloggers writing logical, not extremes. I don't like to follow the extremes. So are there bloggers that are out there that are just doing things on travel?
Yeah, there's all, I mean, green travel specifically. That's one I follow because, again, as we talked about, Legendary World here in Tucson is not a green travel company, but we're a company that's learning to be more green. So for myself, I follow a couple of great blogs. One is called Simple Green Choices.
I'm writing it down.
It's just, it's a great group of people, and they do, they're daily articles. So this is a very active, because again, the problem with social media is you'll run across some that may update once a month. And some that are very active. The UK Guardian is a great source for green. They have a green blogger, and they've got a great a series of articles. One that I was just reading a couple of days ago, they're talking about a new private plane. They're calling it the Flying Prius. So again, it's I found this on these green travel choices, and people are going out and buying electric airplanes for private use, you know, versus the old style.
I'm so ready. And if anyone wants to buy me one, I'm saying yes to that. It's like I'm waiting for the solar plane.
Yeah, no.
It's in my future.
Well, have you been reading about the
solar
recently?
Plane?
Yeah,
yes,
no,
I have.
Just,
and I said, okay, my plane's getting one step closer to me so I can really travel ecologically
without
sound.
Without anybody yelling at you.
But I'm going to have to call mine the Sun Insight. We can't be doing any Prius with Chapman.
Sure.
Yeah, it's okay. That's okay. They're just making it better for us.
That's right. Definitely. No, it's just there's tons out there. I mean, I follow your blog. I mean, you have an amazing blog. And again, the nice part about it is it brings information from all different sources together.
And it does help. I mean, it really does. I wish I had so many more bloggers because I love to do it. But it is feeding the monster. You have to do it all the time.
Right.
And I do a lot more Facebooking, but whatever. So I think it's also interesting what a blog does in studying this whole social media phenomenon upheaval is it's called third-party endorsement. And people want to know what you have to say about where you went as opposed to what where you went has to say. So you're writing about Biltmore because you went sustainability practices. But what they really want to know is when you, Scott, went from Legendary World, were they walking the walk? And people want to hear more about that third-party endorsement than advertising. So that's why there's such chaos.
Well, one of the things I never realized until the comments used to annoy me. But now I've actually, there's a lot of good stuff from the followers of blogs. So I start reading the comments a lot more as well because you actually get a lot of information from people
Absolutely.
That follow. And a lot of it's, garbage.
And it's a way to create controversy too, which I think is great. It's a respectful way to do that. Okay, another fun, it flew by with Scott from Legendary World. You can always find Scott through Mrs. Green's World or going directly to legendaryworld.com. Thank you so much for your informative info on eco.
Mrs. Green.
Okay. We do love Scott, and he's always got great information, and thank you so much for all the good information you share. In studio today with us as well is Robert Glennon, who is the author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. He's also a professor of law at the he is the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona, emphasis on the. So thank you again, Robert, for being in our studio today and sharing all the information you have about water. So where do you want to start with all of the other things we have to talk about? We can talk about desal. I don't want the show to be over without you telling about the property rights that were sold. It was at Utah?
Mm-hmm.
And that story is one that really gets people's attention.
Do you want to start with that one?
Yeah, okay, I think that's great. A really great place to start.
Well, when you think about what we're going to do to take care of this crisis, there is no single
solution.
There is no silver bullet. But there are instead lots of options. And we have, if you will, a menu or a portfolio of things that we can do. Desalination, you mentioned, is one. Reuse or reclaiming water is another. Conservation is a third. I hope we'll get a chance to talk about price signals. But the one that you now are focusing on is really the reallocation of water. Because if you think about it, our water supply is like a giant milkshake glass. And each demand for water is the equivalent of a straw in the glass. And what most states, including Arizona, have permitted is a limitless number of straws in the same glass. Well, of course, that's a recipe for disaster. So what has begun happening around the American West is that states are saying you cannot simply drill a new well or divert more water from the river. You're going to have to persuade someone else to make do with less water by persuading someone to use less. And the story I tell in Unquenchable is a remarkable story about a company in Utah, the Geneva Steel Company. It was a company that was formed by the, it was a steel plant that was built by the U.S. government during the Second World War. By the end of the 20th century, though, the steel industry in the United States is on the ropes. Pittsburgh has 100-year-old blast furnaces. Detroit is making automobiles that no one wants to buy.
Right.
And what happened was that the company came on tough times. And so they needed to first try to reorganize themselves in bankruptcy, but that failed. Okay, so they ended up liquidating all of their assets. And they sold the mine, the land, all of these facilities for $100 million. And then they turned around and sold the water rights for $102 million.
Again, press pause. Everybody listening, the land, $100 million, and the water rights, $102 million. I remember that in one of your presentations.
Are you kidding me? Yeah, it's just stunning. And really, that is the future of water in the United States. And what happened in Utah was that the state engineer, a fellow by the name of Jerry Olds, said, I'm not going to oppose growth, but I'm not going to let growth be mindless. I'm not going to rubber stamp new permits. So if you want to do a deal, you need to bring water to the table. And that's what the Geneva Steel story reflects.
It's really compelling. And again, it talks to all of the, it's to me the whole enchilada of the economics of it, what the visionaries are doing and who's buying that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of pieces to that, a lot of moving parts. We do have a caller, I'm thrilled to say. Bob has a question. We're so
happy
you called in. Good morning,
Bob.
I had a question for Robert. Earlier in the show, you were talking about somebody that wanted to deliver water to Denver and Colorado Springs, but they were going to have to pump it over the Rocky Mountains. Now, I've always had this question, and nobody could ever answer it. How much would the siphoning effect of going down over the other side of the hill assist in the being able to pump the water up going over the hill?
It'll be some. I don't have any data on that. There hasn't been any study on it. Usually what happens is that there's no effort to recapture the energy. For example, let's look at the CAP, which I know a little more about than how Mr. Million's pipeline would operate. The CAP has, at a number of places as it snakes across the desert, taken advantage of contours. So they pump the water up a hill and then let the water flow down the other side. But they're not recapturing any of that energy. Now, I think they could. But that would mean slowing the water flow in order to run it through turbines. So it's an interesting question, Bob.
And
I know everything has to be sealed off when it's going down the other side, when it's going from higher elevation to lower elevation.
Well, the CAP of course isn't.
Siphoning effect.
The CAP is just open to the atmosphere. But if
I know we whined about that the whole time they built it because of the evaporation factor and
right.
on top of that that could happen. We always thought it should be in big pipes.
Well, and the result is that the CAP is the largest consumer of electricity in the state of Arizona.
Another thing I did not know.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Period.
CAP, largest consumer of electricity in the state of Arizona.
Well, because, you know, Bob knows this, but because we're effectively pumping the water up 2,900 feet. Now, the actual atmospheric change from where we take the water out of the river to Tucson is only 2,100 feet. But because it snakes back and forth to take advantage of these contours, the effective pump lift is about 2,900 feet. Well, that's a lot of, and water is heavy.
To get it go uphill.
Water is
very
heavy.
Very, very heavy.
And
when you're hiking,
energy.
You really get that.
Yes, you
I
do.
Want to drink some. Okay, Bob, thank you so much for calling in. And I always remember in the beginning, appreciate your questions, 520-880-5678, if you have questions for Robert today. So we are going to have a quick break in a minute. Can you... there's no really quick way to explain to our listeners what desal is. Maybe that's a better one to come back to after the break and talk about that. And I want to talk about, I have to bring up ethanol, I'm sorry, and we have to talk about water bottles because I'd love you to have your opinion on record about that, even though I already know what it is. News Talk 790 KNST, in-studio guest Robert Glennon, author of Unquenchable. This is Mrs. Green Goes Mainstream. We'll be right back.
790 KNST.
Welcome back, everybody. This is News Talk 790 KNST. This is also Mrs. Green Goes Mainstream. Our in-studio guest today is Robert Glennon from the University of Arizona and also a noted author, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. I'm talking fast because we have lots to cover, and we have a caller. Mary, thanks for calling in. What is your question?
Can't help but perk up when I heard that the issue was water. I spent a year and a half working up in the Eastern Sierra Corridor, up in the Owens River Valley. I worked as a physician of practicing wilderness medicine up there, 2005. I want to say that I became aware of water issues at that time. I read a book called The Bible. I'm sure your guest has read it, by Mark Reisner, called The Cadillac Desert.
Robert, have you heard
about Cadillac? Yeah,
Cadillac.
Okay, sure. Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal book, and he wrote that book in 1986. That's the year I finished medical school, and the issue of water was just on the horizon, but how presage he was. Now, I wanted to say that the early years of the formation of L.A. County, it was... the issue that created land wars up in that valley, and the remnants of those hostilities persist even today toward the people of L.A. County, as you probably studied. Mulholland, who is the grandfather of L.A., sent his goons up into the Owens River Valley to purchase all of the water rights and the land from the people who live up in that valley. During the early 20s, there were big wars. Talk about terrorism. It was at a high end during that time. People resisted having their land taken over by the so-called effete intellectual snobs of L.A. And even today, there's very little private land ownership because it all pretty much is owned by L.A. County. There's a great deal of hostility, and I saw a great deal of neurosis on the part of the people who live there. They have such a magnificent love-hate relationship toward the folks of L.A. because their land values are locked in. They're very limited, and therefore the prices go up, but those people are very poor up in that area. And
It's a very interesting and rich story that you refer to, Mary, and Mark Reisner's Cadillac Desert is indeed the classic. There's a more recent book by Gary Leibkap on called Chinatown Revisited, because the Chinatown references, of course, the movie Chinatown that chronicles L.A.'s ripping off of far rural farmland. The Owens Valley, though, remains pristine in part because it never developed. And one of the things that Leibkap shows in his book is that The farmers sold out willingly to L.A., and the farmers indeed banded together and negotiated together in order to get decent prices from the city of L.A. in the 19-teens and 1920s. And then a friend of mine who teaches at Stanford told me, oh, yes, my grandfather was one of those. And then he went down to the San Joaquin Valley and started farming down there. Now, if you think about it, that's really quite amazing, because what happened basically was that the farmers in the high desert, which is not very good for growing anything, sold out to L.A., but then they bought land down in the fertile area and used the same water that L.A. bought until L.A. needed it back, and then they became fabulously rich by selling the water back to L.A. Fairly
there was definitely an entrepreneurial edge. Mary, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate your call, appreciate you for listening, and appreciate that input. So, Robert, this is now going to be the whirling dervish, because there's so much more to cover. What about price? To me, one of the things is water is almost free. That's how I feel. Like, I don't even know how much my water bill is. I know how much my electricity bill is. How much does that reflect people's attitudes?
Huge. It's huge. And as you know, I have a whole chapter on the price of water. In fact, it is free. Even in Tucson, where we have a wonderful utility, Tucson Water, very progressive, we have increasing block rates. They are seasonally adjusted to encourage conservation.
The
more you use, the more you pay. But still, those rates are revenue neutral. That is, that the amount of money that is generated by the water rates is supposed to be equal to the cost of the utility for providing the service. There is no commodity charge for the water itself. And that's in a good system. And fully a third of American cities have decreasing block rates, where you are rewarding people for using more water by charging them less for that final unit of water. And in some places, there aren't even meters. In the city of Fresno, city of Sacramento, there have been no meters. They're starting finally to meter the water. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that if you can give the conservation signal through price signals, that people will conserve. And that's one of the things we absolutely must do.
And what about, you know, just the numbers, just running the numbers. What about bottled water? I mean, I harp on that. I go a little bit over the edge, and I say to people, it's great if you recycle the bottle. That's not the real deal. It's reducing your use of a plastic water bottle.
Yeah. I was the first to blow the whistle on bottled water in my book, Water Follies, and I'm not a fan of bottled water. It takes a lot of water to make the bottle. It takes a lot of water to treat the water, to put the water in the bottle.
If they even treat it at all. They do charge you for it.
It depends on which company.
Right.
There's no assurance that the water is high quality. It's basically unregulated. It costs 1,000 times more than water out of your tap, and doesn't, in most instances, have the same protections as tap water does. So it's fairly bizarre. On the other hand, for some people, what they're doing is they're drinking water instead of soda. So the real comparison shouldn't be between bottled water and tap water. It's between bottled water and, say, Coca-Cola or Gatorade. And so when you put that into the mix, then the price comparison is different. And the environmental consequence is different, because these other bottles or other beverages also come in some sort of plastic or aluminum container, and that takes energy to make and then to recycle. Still, it's kind of a cultural phenomenon. It's taken the country by storm. But there is tremendous pushback. All around the country, groups are forming to oppose bottled water. I spent a day at a high school in New Jersey last spring, where these high school students had a campaign to get their fellow students to use hard, renewable bottles, plastic or stainless steel, and put their water in that. The students even had the students from the fine arts part of the high school do drawings. So you had your own hand-drawn stainless steel bottle that the high school students were producing for you. So for me, what bottled water is about is it's kind of an epitome of an indulgent society, use and discard.
And being conscious of it, just egregious waste. It's just egregious waste. We just dispose of things.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about this. I want to make sure we get in the show where people can get your book, because it is a great book. It is
Thank
for
you.
The reader like me. And I say that with respect to me, too. I don't want to read about metric tables and this and that and a lot of science. You wrote a book that the public can read and digest and understand. And I really enjoyed reading the book. And like I said, dog-eared it. I get it. Lots Thanks. Of light bulbs go on. So where can they get your book?
Well, I'm a big fan of independent bookstores. So if you've, if you've got an independent bookstore that you
go there first, go there and request it.
Beyond that, the easiest thing and probably the cheapest thing is Amazon.
Amazon.com,
yep.
Which is okay. Maybe someday soon, Bookman's is going online. So when they go online, I needed a book the other day. I went in and they had three copies and I bought every one of them because I give them out to girlfriends. But why would you buy a new book? I got three books for the price of what the one what it would be if I went to a commercial big box bookstore, as I call them. So we have how much we have to wrap up. I cannot believe this. We never got to ethanol. I'm sure that you'll be back. You have another book that you're working on. So you've got a spot on Mrs. Green. I can tell you that. And say hi to Karen for me.
Thanks. This Good to be with you, Gina.
News Talk 790 KNST. Robert Glennon. Check out his book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What We Can Do About It. Tune in next week and have a great weekend. Stay cool. These are the things I can do.